Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yose, your host. Thank you for joining us for our first of 2 hours on this Thursday. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9, and don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yose. That is my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page. If you have information, insight, or breaking news you want to share with me, I'll share with the people, unless you don't want me to, and I won't. Coming up in the second hour of the show, you know what time it is. But before we get to Dave on Love, with the tragic death of Khalif Browder, we turn to Brittany Oliver, who is the police coordinator for the Maryland ACLU. Brittany, let me make sure I got that. Wait a minute, your title right. The Police Accountability Coordinator for the Maryland ACLU. Brittany Oliver, welcome to First Edition.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for taking time to talk to us, Brittany. So this is what I want to do. I want to take our time to unpack this case of Khalif Browder. He's come back into our consciousness because of this new documentary that is out. As a matter of fact, I believe the third of six parts airs tonight. Mm-hmm. It's called Time, the Khalif Browder story. So let's go back to 2010 when this young man, I think he was 16 years old at the time, was arrested allegedly for stealing a backpack in New York. Let's talk about that.
Sure. And, you know, with this story, you know, it's really important to talk, you know, to talk this through, you know, so we can give some folks some context to why bail reform is an issue.
Absolutely.
In our country.
Absolutely.
He was, you know, Khalif was a 22-year-old Black American man who basically spent 3 years in jail without ever being convicted of the crime that he was charged for.
More than 1,100 days.
Yes, yeah. that is correct. He was 16 years old, as you stated, when he was arrested in 2010 for allegedly stealing a backpack. The charges is that it was robbery, grand larceny, and as well as assault. His bail was set for $3,000.
Right.
And because his family could not afford it, he couldn't go home, and he was charged. Not only was he charged, but he was also sent to Rikers Island Jail in New York City.
Now let's help people understand. I mean, I think Rikers Island is kind of a part of the American lexicon in the sense of these kind of horrific places to go to jail. I mean, Rikers Island, for people who don't know what Rikers Island is in New York, if anybody's familiar with what Jessup used to be, what we used to call the Cut in Maryland, that's sort of the same reputation that Rikers Island enjoys, not enjoys, but has in New York City.
Right. So Rikers Island is one, you know, folks may have heard of it, you know, on in other stories, you know, in relation to this, but it is New York City's main jail complex,
right?
And it is operated by the New York City Department of Corrections.
Right.
It has a budget of at least $86 million a year, about 9,000 officers that occupy the space. It is one of the world's largest correctional institutions and mental institutions.
And a horrible institution. I mean, it has a horrible reputation. Right. It has for decades.
Yes, for decades. When he was sent to Rikers Island just because he couldn't afford the bail for $3,000,
right.
You know, I mean, this... I mean, that's just outrageous.
Well, and then even more outrageous than that, Brittany, after 74 days, his bail was revoked altogether.
Yes.
So then he had to stay in jail.
He had to stay. He had to stay in there. And he had also been repeatedly been offered plea deals that he rejected over and over and over again. By the time he left Rikers, he had spent almost 800 days in solitary confinement.
So what was the, to your knowledge, Brittany, what was the rationale for Rikers Island officials to place him in solitary confinement for more than 800 days at Rikers Island for stealing a backpack, allegedly stealing a backpack?
I mean, my rationale would be there is no rationale for that.
But did they offer any sort of rationale? I mean, of course, it's ridiculous. It's outrageous. It's inhuman, actually.
Yeah, it's definitely, inhumane. I mean, the prosecutors at some point, realized that they had no case and had dismissed the charges. But even before then, again, there is no rationale for that.
Of course not.
A lot of it, especially when you are caught into the system in that way, it's kind of like there's no way out. It is an example of systemic and institutional racism. It's a part of the prison industrial complex. There is no rationale for that.
Go ahead, Brittany.
And I was going to say again, by the time the prosecutors had realized that he had no case, and they dismissed the charges, he was released in 2013, but the damage had already been done. His physical state, his mental state, I mean, his entire life had been ruined.
He had said he was released on June 5th of 2015. He had told the New Yorker at some point along the way, quote, "I'm not all right. I'm messed up." He was released on June 5th, 2015. The next day, June 6th, 2015, he killed himself. He committed suicide.
Right. He hung himself with an air conditioner cord.
Right.
He was 22 years old.
Right.
His story matters. It matters for his family. It matters for his community. It also matters for our entire nation and as well as Maryland. The problem is that hundreds of Americans who have not been convicted of a crime sit in jail because they're too poor to be able to afford bail amount. And in other words, their wealth basically determines whether or not they're incarcerated.
Right.
How is that okay? It's not okay, and it's also it's alarming. His story, of not being able to afford bail, it's very. His story is different, but, we could also think about this in terms of Sandra Bland, who sat in jail for 3 days after being arrested for not posting a $5,000 bond that had been set. And posting her bond would have required her only to be able to come up with about $500,
right.
Which is 10% of the full sum in exchange for freedom.
Right.
So this issue is also a women's rights issue as well.
Of course. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yoes, your host. We're revisiting the tragic death of Khalif Browder, the young man who was jailed at Rikers Island in 2010, spent over 1,100 days at Rikers Island, over 800 days in solitary confinement for allegedly stealing a backpack. Ultimately, case was dropped. Charges were dropped. The prosecutors had no case. He was released from jail. He was released from Rikers on June 5th. On June 6th, the next day, he hung himself. He committed suicide. It seemed clear that his time at Rikers Island for not stealing a backpack, because ultimately he was not guilty. The charges were dropped. Obviously, the time at Rikers Island devastated him. We're unpacking this case and talking about the issue of bail reform with Brittany Oliver of the ACLU. She's the Police Accountability Coordinator for the ACLU of Maryland. So what this comes down to, Brittany, obviously, Khalif Browder is one of literally millions of people, mostly black, mostly poor people of color across this nation, who cannot afford to post bail. That it's as simple as that. The vast majority of them are being jailed for nonviolent offenses. Some of them jailed for misdemeanor offenses. And this is the situation we find ourselves in because, to a great extent, locking people up is just big business, and it makes a lot of money for a lot of people. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Sure. I mean, pre-trial detention, it is one of the most overlooked human rights crises. You know, the jail is nearly 500,000 people at any given time, and it fuels over-incarceration by inducing, you know, guilty plea deals, which forces people to lose jobs, lose housing. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And the inability to afford bail ruins lives. It has a negative impact on communities of color, as you mentioned, especially Black communities.
Oh, indeed. I mean, so if we just go back to a few years ago with the implementation of the zero tolerance policing policy, we know that there were literally hundreds. We averaged for a span of several years 100,000 people being arrested in Baltimore, which is about one sixth of the city's population. Many thousands of those people were never charged with a crime, and yet they weren't able to expunge their records. They weren't able to remove that stain, if you will. And in the process, they lost jobs, they lost homes, some people lost families. It was devastating to the Black community in Baltimore City, and the ramifications of it are still resonating to this day.
Definitely. I mean, when you think back to the Baltimore uprising, you know, that took place, you know, the issues that communities of color, especially Black communities in Baltimore, which is a predominantly Black city, you know, issues such as bail reform, you know, having to deal with systems that systemically, you know, ruins our lives and keeps folks from, you know, having fair access. You know, the criminal justice system is not just as long as we have these issues.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, Brittany, how, and for those who are listening, I just want to kind of give you a preview. After we conclude the interview with Brittany Oliver, we're going to talk to Davon Love of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. We're going to talk about the bail reform battle here in Maryland. Important news today coming down from Annapolis, as a matter of fact. So it's a timely discussion. But let's talk about how the detention system works and why it's inherently really biased against poor people and Black people, people of color, but poor people in particular.
Right. I mean, so the pre-trial detention is basically a process that keeps a person who has been arrested in custody before conviction. Those charged with serious crimes may be held in a prison until trial or sentencing. It varies depending on what the case is. But again, it's an issue that often goes over. That often goes overlooked as a crisis, and so right now with the Maryland General Assembly at the ACLU, you know, we are supporting, you know, legislation right now that in an effort to reform the bail bonds industries, which you'll hear more about coming from Davon. But, you know, overall at the ACLU, we reject systems that require money in exchange for freedom because it's an abuse of power and it's a threat to civil rights, especially basic human rights.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. Let's take a couple of phone calls, Brittany. People want to get into the conversation while we have a few minutes left. Let's go to Don and Glenn Burney. Don, you're on First Edition. How you doing?
Hey, Sean. Hi. Well, man, you know, it's absolutely criminal what they did to this young man. And others like him. Now, from what I understand, that wasn't he offered a plea bargain, and he got out early, but he didn't want to admit to a crime that he didn't commit?
Absolutely true.
Hey, anybody involved in stuff like that, It should be a special place in, you know, where for them.
Well, I think a lot of people would agree with that assessment, Don. Don, thank you for calling, brother. I appreciate you. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Sean in Florida. Sean, you're on First Edition.
Hey, how's it going?
All right, man.
Sean, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, man. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you. Go, Sean.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I personally have had, myself, I've been on a pretrial diversion. I've also had where I couldn't get out. And I believe that it's really a broader problem, and it's not just touching the communities of color. It also hits the white communities that are poor as well.
Sure, of course.
There are a lot of you know, inner city and also you know, suburb communities of white people who don't have a lot of funds and that are not able to make bail, and
rural communities, as a matter of fact.
Yes, absolutely. It takes families with their you know, their parents away from their children, where the breadwinner is no longer there anymore,
right,
to take care of their family,
right.
And it's and I know that it is a big business thing, and we really need to you know, make an effort to try to change the entire judicial system and the way that we imprison our people, and I think we really need to reflect on this and change it. We need to make an effort to change it.
Absolutely. Sean, I thank you for calling in, especially calling in from Florida and relaying your experience and making it clear. And as we were making it clear that typically, disproportionately, this system, this inequitable system, does disproportionately affect black people and people of color. But it's poor people, ultimately, and poor people of all races that get almost always caught up in the system. 90% of the people who are caught up in the bail system in Baltimore City, 90% are black people. And the vast majority of those people are poor people. And there are white people in that population as well, of course, who are caught up in the system because they can't post bail. As we go forward, Brittany, you know, one of the things that Sean just said is that we need to reflect on this, and we need to kind of strategize how to correct it. But in the atmosphere, the political atmosphere we find ourselves in, it seems like it is more difficult now, perhaps more difficult now than ever, to try to fight against this system, given the context in which we're operating. What are your thoughts about that?
So my thoughts, and you're right about that. What I will say, what I can say, is that nothing can bring Khalif back,
right,
but his tragic death is not an end to his story. And one of the many ways that we can honor him and countless others is by never giving up on this issue. While national news is, you know, flooding our airways and social media channels, we can't forget about the issues here that need our attention on a local level as well. And again, as long as we're fighting for reform, you know, our criminal, quote unquote, justice system is not just until we're able to, you know, to overcome an issue such as bail reform. And there are a lot of efforts that the ACLU of Maryland support right now, the Maryland General Assembly, in an effort to reform the bail bond industry right now.
What do you have a number? I'm pretty sure I've stated it before, but how many millions of dollars flows through the bail bond industry in Maryland? Do you have a number for that, Brittany? I don't mean to catch you off guard, but I know I've stated the number before. I just don't have it in front of me.
The bail within the bail bond industry in Maryland, the cost for it is outrageous, and I know that we can get into a little bit more in specifics in terms of Maryland in comparison to other states, and what the cost of those things are.
Right. I mean, I like I said, I don't have the numbers in front of me necessarily, but I just know that ultimately, and what I'm really getting at, the bottom line is that the bail industry is incredibly powerful in this state. I think the only other union, or rather the only other lobby more, perhaps more powerful than the bail lobby is the FOP. But I mean, that, even that's debatable, I think. For people who understand the political dynamics in this state, that should put it in a pretty plain context. When you're neck and neck with the FOP as far as lobbying power is concerned, you're in a very powerful position in this state. So, again,
definitely.
Unfortunately, again, we are revisiting the tragic death of Khalif Browder, but it is a story. A true story that should inform us all about the incredible inequity of the criminal justice system and specifically the pretrial detention system in the United States. Brittany Oliver is Police Accountability Coordinator and Communication Associate with the Maryland ACLU. Brittany, thank you so much for joining us this evening. We appreciate your time.
Sure. Thank you.
All right. We're going to go to a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue the discussion about bail reform and specifically focus in on the efforts of bail reform in Maryland. We will be joined by Davon Love of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. That's next. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. Welcome back to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yost, your host, as we continue the conversation, making the transition from our interview with Brittany Oliver of the ACLU to Davon Love of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle as we update the efforts at bail reform in the state of Maryland. Davon, welcome back, sir. We appreciate your time, man.
Thanks for having me on, Sean.
Of course. So some news today. The Legislative Black Caucus, the Maryland Legislative Black Caucus, voted today, as a matter of fact, to recommend that the General Assembly take no action on any of the bail reform bills before it this year. Tell us what that sentence right there, for those who want to see reform, at least on the surface, it doesn't sound good. But from your perspective, Davon, what does that mean? Well, let's unpack that a little bit.
So just to give some backstory.
Sure.
So in the beginning of session, there were those of us that were geared up to address the issue of the fact there were too many people detained pretrial because they can't afford to pay. And parallel to that effort was an effort in the Court of Appeals, highest court of the state, to do what's called a rule change. And essentially what that rule change would do is instruct judges to avoid the use of bail when necessary to consider how much a person can pay.
And that rule change was pushed by Maryland Attorney General Brian Frosch, correct?
Correct, okay. Correct. It was sparked by his opinion that he issued in October.
Right.
So that Court of Appeals ruling was successful, and it takes effect in July. So those of us that were working on the legislative track saw pushing legislation to help strengthen what the Court of Appeals had already done. In addition to things like risk assessment tools, the involvement of community and pretrial, stuff like that. The issue, to be honest with you and your listeners, is that the bail bonds industry was responding to the Court of Appeals ruling.
Right.
And what they did was support a legislation that would undo the Court of Appeals ruling in the name of bail reform.
Right.
And, you know, as we'll probably talk more about, as the show proceeds, you know, unfortunately, the bail bonds industry has been very effective at getting to some of our legislators and pushing for legislation to undo the Court of Appeals ruling.
Right.
So what the Legislative Black Caucus did this morning, and I just want to be clear to clarify, because it wasn't entirely clear during the meeting, but what they actually voted in support of was to oppose anything that comes out of the Senate committee, which is the most likely committee that a pretrial bill will come out of. And the reason that's important is because Senator Zirkin, who's the chairman of that committee,
right,
is either the second or third highest beneficiary of campaign contributions from the bail bonds industry.
Exactly.
And is really interested in passing a bill that undermines the Court of Appeals ruling. So if a bill gets out of the Senate, it will undo the Court of Appeals ruling. And so from a strategic standpoint, we'd rather say oppose any legislative action, let the Court of Appeals ruling take effect in July, see how that goes, and then look at legislation next year, than to risk putting forward a bill on the floor that would undermine the Court of Appeals ruling.
All right. So what we're saying here is that from your perspective with Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, you want to oppose the bills, the bail reform bills, to allow for the Court of Appeals ruling to take effect rather than jeopardize that Court of Appeal ruling being jeopardized. Is that accurate? Okay.
Exactly. Because the bail bonds industry has been supporting legislation that would undo it.
Right.
And like I said, just to be honest, you know, they're very powerful. And we fear that anything that, let's say we're able to get a good version of our bill on the floor.
Right.
We're fearful that the bail bonds industry would influence leadership to amend it in ways that would undo the Court of Appeals ruling. So we think we're better off allowing the Court of Appeals ruling to go forward and to see what happens, as opposed to risking putting it on the floor and have it amended in a way that undermines the ruling.
Exactly true. And given the history, quite frankly, of Senator Zirkin, and as you just alluded to the fact that he receives a tremendous amount of financial contributions from the bail industry. He is a absolute proponent for police law enforcement. I mean, his record is clear. Given that background, the ability or the likelihood of political machinations taking place that would undo good work as far as reforming the bail system is concerned, seems that like there's a high percentage of that possibility.
Exactly. And that's what we want to avoid. I mean, we would ideally like the bill that we were supporting, that we were supporting before House Bill 1390, Senate Bill 880, which is the bill that advocates, the public defender, the attorney general were very supportive of. I mean, we'd like in a world ideally where that would pass, but we just, in terms of the political realities here in Annapolis, we're clear that the bail bond industry has just been very effective at getting legislators to put in bills that would undermine the Court of Appeals ruling, and it just made it difficult to feel confident that we could put something on the floor that won't undo it.
So let's look at the action of the Black Caucus. I saw some posts, I believe a few days ago, it was you and your partner Adam of LBS, really calling the Black Caucus out, along with the NAACP, if I'm remembering correctly, on their actions or inaction as far as the bail reform process has been or the bail reform effort has been. What is your assessment of the motivation of the Black Caucus here, Davon, given the fact that the vast, vast majority of people who are caught up in this bail reform, the bail system, especially the pretrial detention system, are poor people of color? How do you explain, can you explain the actions of the Black Caucus of Maryland on this?
Well, a couple things, Sean. The first is that, I'm extremely disappointed in the traditional civil rights organization who came out to support the bail bond industry's bill, House Bill 1215, Senate Bill 983. It's a bill that undoes the Court of Appeals ruling. And it's the only bill that the bail bonds industry has been supportive of and are trying to get through, in spite of the fact the Attorney General was suggested that no action should be taken. And so, to be honest with you, I feel pretty confident that there are certain aspects of our communities who we think have been paid off.
Wow.
To undermine legitimate pretrial reform. And when I say our communities, I'm talking about Black folks.
Right.
Who've been paid off. This is maybe my fifth time being pretty consistently present at Annapolis joint session. And this is, really the most disappointed I've been, collectively in our Black legislators. And this isn't to say all of them, have been problematic. But this is an issue that pretty, like you said, pretty clearly undermines the quality of life of black people. And if you look at the report the Office of the Public Defender did, the high cost of bail, I mean, it shows that not only the high amount of profit that this industry makes off of our people, we're talking $250 million over the past 5 years, $75 million off of people who've been convicted of nothing, right?
Right.
But if you look at the graph, it is disproportionately black folks more than anybody else. And so now, as I kind of posted this morning, I'm grateful that our caucus, in an 18-13 vote, decided to take the action that we wanted them to, which is to recommend that no legislative action be taken and oppose any legislative action that moves forward on pretrial and bail reform bills. But the state conference NAACP, the SCLC, the Greater Baltimore Urban League, and the local chapter of the National Action Network have demonstrated themselves to be supporters of the bail bonds industry.
How does that? I mean, I get money. I understand. I mean, I remember y'all reporting from Annapolis or posting on social media that the bail bond industry was doling out dinners at Ruth Chris Steakhouse. Lovely place, you know. So when you up the ante to Ruth's Chris for some of these cats, I mean, I've said before many times that, you know, Swedish meatballs and box wine will suffice a lot of these people. So when you go take it up to, I shouldn't try to be funny about it, but I mean, it doesn't take much, is I guess the point, to, for lack of a better term, buy off certain people. I mean, For those organizations that you named, Davon, to be in bed with the bail bond industry seems it's breathtaking to me.
Well, and if I can add, the thing that has made it even more disappointing is not just their support of it, but there are a bunch of folks, them and others, who are angry at folks like myself and other advocates for pointing this out, right? People that have said that we're spreading lies, we're spreading alternative facts.
Man.
I mean,
man.
We have the testimony on the record of legislators state NAACP, SCLC, National Action Network. We have the testimony on the record. They were supportive of the bill that was pushed forward by the bail bonds industry. You know, and, you know, so what's been even more frustrating is that they're angry with us. About us, you know, telling people about the fact that that's what they did. Additionally, the dinner you referenced. So, you know, we found out, myself and other advocates found out, that through the Black Caucus email, the invitation to that dinner was sent out. And so we had asked the chairwoman, Delegate Cheryl Glenn, about why she would send out an invitation to a dinner from the bail bonds industry, given that it was a priority of the caucus going into the General Assembly. But it just seems counterintuitive, right? What she said to myself and others was, you know, the dinners that happened at her all the time, just because you go to a dinner doesn't mean that you support it. I probably won't even go, right? These were the things that she said in April. She had promised us that she would stand with us at a press conference the following day. Right? Now, we're clear that, sure, you know, some people will go to dinners and may not necessarily support the industry that's hosting it, right? The issue for us is that we made it a point to go to the dinner to see who sit across the room for the reception,
right,
see who went in and out, and report to the public who was present. And the response that we got back in return was hostility, was anger. How dare you, you know, question our integrity? Was with some of the things that were said to us. And one of the things that's been frustrating is that if you're a person that's committed to pretrial reform and you happen to go to a dinner, then you shouldn't be upset that we're telling the public that you were present, because we should be able to clearly count on your vote and your voice for meaningful pretrial reform.
If you got nothing to hide, what is this old saying that says only a struck dog hollers or something like that? I don't know what that
right,
means.
Right. And so just the level of, I've had legislators say to me that there are still black legislators that are upset, right, with me and others. And what's frustrating is that they won't say it directly to me, right? They'll say to other folks, and what they've done is many of them have attempted to attack colleagues of ours who, you know, work for, you know, more traditional mainstream organizations, right? Because LBS is the kind of organization it is, you know, there are no phone calls you can make to undermine our voice, right? But we're seeing that there are folks who, you know, are being attacked because they're supporting an effort that we all agree is an important thing for our community. And so the reason why I just wanted to put that out there is because, you know, we can't continue, but this session has showed me we can't continue to do the backroom deals. We can't continue to do the you're my friend, so you can't criticize me in public, right? And to be honest with you, I think had LBS not been involved in trying to publicize the things that were happening on this effort, I think a bill would have already went through to undo the Court of Appeals ruling.
Unfortunately, I think you're right, Davon. I mean, I think that, I mean, given the fact that, I mean, just knowing Annapolis, understanding it a little bit after covering it for several years, I don't think there's any doubt of what you just said. What would have happened? That would have been the outcome. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yost, your host. We're talking about the effort at bail reform here in the state of Maryland. On the phone, we have Davon Love of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, one of the lead advocates for substantial, authentic bail reform in this state. Bail reform obviously is an issue. Bail and pretrial detention specifically is a system within the criminal justice system that disproportionately affects black people, poor people, people of color, of course. Let's go to the phones, though, Davon. A few people want to get into the conversation. Let's go to Brother Leo Burroughs in Bolton Hills. Brother Burroughs, welcome to the show.
Yes. Good evening, Brother Davon Love and Sean Yost and everybody. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, Davon, keep doing what you're doing. It is a beautiful struggle. We've got to remain resilient, and we commend you and praise you all for fighting for justice, because you've got a bunch of conservative right-wing Negroes in the legislative Black caucus. And it is not so that all of them are bad people, but let's look at Adrian Jones, who's pro tem in the House of Delegates. Am I correct?
Yes,
Adrian Jones, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay, Adrian Jones. What position does she hold? Senator Nathaniel McFadden, Senator Dolores Kelly, Kurt Anderson. Hasn't he been there 30 years or more? You've got a lot of black folk. Just check out their seniority and their tenure in Annapolis. You've got a lot of black folks who've been there 20, 25, 30 years. And they don't want to rock the boat because they are proud clones of Mike Miller, the president of the state Senate, and proud clones of Mike Bush, the speaker of the House of Delegates. And they're going to play ball because they're professional politicians. They don't want to get unseated. And as long as they can quietly work behind the scenes through skullduggery and do what the powers that be say they should do, they're going to do it. I hope you will continue to publish, if you haven't already done so, a report card on all of these legislators that we are more than happy to distribute among our constituents and folks in Baltimore and throughout the state and nation. NAACP doesn't surprise me. The Urban League doesn't surprise me. Old-line organizations not going to change the status quo. Right. In fact, they're very comfortable with the status quo.
All right.
So let's try to upset it and keep fighting. And again, we're very proud of your initiatives and your courage.
Brother Burroughs,
thank you.
Thank you for your call, Brother
thank
Burroughs.
You.
We appreciate you. Let's go to Joanne in Baltimore. Joanne or Joan? Next, you're on First Edition.
Yes, sir. Brother Burroughs, thank you for your thank you call. Brother Burroughs, we appreciate you. Let's go to Joanne in Baltimore.
Probably should turn your radio down, Joanne.
Yes, hello.
Oh, hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I am in tune with, I'm in tune with Mr. Burroughs. These folks wouldn't support black people for no reason. The people in charge of the bond issue are getting away with bilking and putting people in jail for no reason. Uh-huh. It is sad when people have to pay all this money just to prove their innocence. Right. It's wrong. Please keep standing up for justice. I applaud you and support you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sister, for your time, for calling in. We appreciate it. Let's go to Donna. Yes. Bye-bye. Let's go to Donna in Baltimore. Donna, you're on First Edition. How you doing?
Pretty good. How you doing?
All right, sis.
I was there at the Black Caucus, and I think all, to be fair, I think it would also be good to have Cheryl Glenn and Kurt Anderson there, especially Kurt Anderson, who actually wrote one of the bills. I just think that, you know, it's in, you know, when you hear one side of the story, it's fair to hear the other side. So, I mean, I'm recommended that you also have Cheryl Glenn and Kurt Anderson to come on and explain their side, because I was there and, it was a lot of things going on and a lot of decisions and amendments and motions that we report. So I just think it'd be fair to hear the other side. And finally, there's no law that says you cannot sit down with a lobbyist. Because if we don't keep our ears open in how lobbyists with any group operates, how are we going to know how to play that chess game? So I'm not saying sell yourself out, but we have to always know what the other side is thinking and planning so we can outmaneuver them. And that's all I have to say.
Right.
Thank you.
And go ahead, Devon. I think you wanted to say something there.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, going back to the post that I made about the dinner at Ruth's Chris, you know, our position isn't that necessarily those legislators were wrong for going. You know, there are legislators on that list of people who, you know, I like, who I think are, you know, pretty decent legislators. You know, it was just for the purpose of having it on the record that people knew that. My issue was with the response we got from some of the members of the legislature, particularly the Black ones,
right,
that were upset that we put that out in the public.
Well, and then, right? let's be clear, Devon. Look, this is, we are at an incredibly pivotal moment in our nation's history, in the state's history, in the city's history. Nobody is above reproach. Nobody is untouchable, at least not in my mind, as far as legislators are concerned. You know, no harm, no foul. If you are at that dinner and you have the right intentions and you have the right motivation, then you have nothing to hide and you should have nothing to fear. So just because you posted the names, I don't see why there should be this reprimanding of you all for doing so. It's about transparency, and we need that more now than we ever have, I think, especially in this state.
And if I could just add to that, I mean, the thing that, again, it's not just, you know, the traditional civil rights organizations supporting the bail bonds industries bill. It's not just the fact that we have some of our Black legislators supporting the bail bonds industries bill. It's been the animus towards us criticizing folks for doing that. You know, I had one of the people that I mentioned in that post was a guy named Frank Boston, who's a lobbyist who was on the other side of us on police reform, and he was on the other side of the bail bonds industry. He was upset because I named him in that post as a Black lobbyist that often is deployed to undermine our efforts, right? Because he was similarly positioned on police reform. And him and I had a conversation. And one of the things that I said to him, I said, look, you know, you made decisions about what you support and what you represent. And so you have the responsibility to be accountable for the decisions you make in public. And that if I make a characterization of your work that is factual, we can disagree about what you think is right or wrong. But to say that it was somehow below the belt or beyond the pale to make that criticism, as long as I don't say anything that is untrue or anything that was said to me in confidence in public, then you take a public position if you're in a position to affect public policy, and you should be accountable to the decisions you make, and that it shouldn't be construed as a personal attack, right? It should be understood as holding people accountable for the decisions they make in this arena of public policy.
I think that's fair. And I take Donna's suggestion. Kurt Anderson actually lives in close proximity to WEAA. He's been on the show many times. Cheryl Glenn has been invited on the show before as well. Kurt Anderson is an open door policy at First Edition. I think he knows that. So have no problem bringing the delegate on to air his side of how this thing played out, as well as Cheryl Glenn, who is the chair of the Black Caucus. So, again, that's an open invitation to both of them. Let's go back to the phones, though. Let's go to Charles in Baltimore. Charles, you're on First Edition with Davon Love. How you doing?
Yes, how you doing, Davon? How you doing, Sean?
Yes, sir.
Davon, I heard you about, I think it was about a week ago, when a couple people tried to sandbag you. They ganged up on you on another station. Cheryl Glenn was one, and Larry Young, ex-senator, is the other. And they tried to get you. I want to applaud you, by the way, for the way you handled yourself. They tried to gang up on you. And you handled yourself very well. It was like a sandbag job. And you know, I simply want to mention this though. If Leo gonna start mentioning names, he needs to mention all the names. Okay, just don't pick McFadden and a handful that he used to attack him on the air. Mention Larry Young also. He was part of that attempt to sandbag you. And I know why Leo don't want to do that, because he don't want to lose his airtime on that station. But I just wanted to congratulate you for the way you. Well, and I think it's kind of indefensible on the part of Cheryl Glenn, by the way. I think the whole, you know, her whole defense, she don't like for someone challenging her integrity. So what does that sound like? What kind of foolishness is that? Mm-hmm. I mean. When I heard that alone, I knew that you was well in her kitchen. So, you know, just keep on doing what you do. But I want to say, Leo, call all the names from now on. Mm-hmm. Don't just call the ones that are acceptable to attack on the air.
All right. Charles, thank you. Let's take one more call, Davon. Let's go to T in Baltimore. T, you're on First Edition with Davon Love. How you doing?
I'm well, thank you. Thank you for having me on the station and taking the call.
Sure.
I appreciate the discourse. And I think that it's very clear, heir apparent, what the plans are for us from the current abomination at 1600 on down throughout the political system and what has transpired. I think that we need more political discourse so people understand, so people can be able to make proper decisions for themselves and actually hold people accountable. So I applaud what you're doing. I'm with the gentleman who just hung up. I think that people should be called out for their positions, and they should either defend their position, or they should be challenged. I mean, they should defend their position and also be challenged on their positions. I mean, that's the rule of political discourse. It's just that things have been so skewed and distorted. People take positions, make back deals, and feel like they shouldn't be challenged. Well, you were elected to represent a population supposed to take our concerns, the people who you represent, you're supposed to champion those things. So I appreciate you guys, continuing to do what you do. Please stay on it. Please pick up other issues that impact. Because I heard Sean say, you know, this reform impacts poor people and people of color. And we have to now say that because of the intersectionality thing. But specifically, people of color, specifically Black people.
No doubt.
Specifically.
No doubt.
So thank you, guys.
Sure.
Thank you.
T,
bye-bye.
T, thank you. For your comment, appreciate it. Davon, we don't have a lot of time left, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask you in a minute or so to give me your thoughts on, because we haven't talked since the indictment of those seven police officers on racketeering charges. What is the ongoing narrative about the Baltimore City Police Department sound like now, given what has transpired over the last couple of weeks?
I mean, I would say, you know, something I've said, you know, quite frequently, which is that we have a police union that functionally behaves as a special interest group funded by public dollars that undermines our ability to hold the law enforcement agencies accountable. And so I think that those indictments are just proof of that institutional arrangement that both is profitable for an industry that isn't accountable to our communities, but it's also harmful in our ability to hold public safety accountable. It's a third of the city's budget. Right. It's a successful business model.
Yeah.
And So a part of what I think we need to do is really begin to, you know, attack the legitimacy of the FOP as an organization. I mean, if they represent a sector that's responsible for our safety, I think we need to begin to start questioning whether the FOP is an entity that is in the public's interest. Because in all of our work on police accountability, they've not only been an adversary, but have not even been willing to concede to things that I think make sense to the average right. person. I mean, there's a reason they don't want civilians on the police job board.
Right, right.
You know?
Right. Davon Love is co-founder of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Brother Davon, it's always a pleasure to hear from you, brother. We appreciate you, and we appreciate your work as always.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
All right. We're going to go to a quick break. When we come back, second hour, first edition, the infamous NWA Sports Report. Stay tuned. ¶¶